Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 227 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the first of a two-part interview, Lucy Moore speaks with James McConachie about recovering the life of a Civil War aristocrat from her receipt book, the roots of chemistry in the housewife's distilling room, and the contrasting attitudes of Puritans and Royalists to the role of women in society.
I'm sitting with the writer and historian, Lucy Moore, who is fresh from the publication of her eighth book, Lady Fanshawe's Receipt Book. It is a book about women's history in the context of all history, it seems to be. And my first question to you, Lucy, was, do you conceive of yourself as a woman's historian, as a feminist historian, or simply as a historian? What do you say?
I've always thought of myself just as a historian, although I do think that the stories of people who are slightly marginalised and struggling against a system are often more interesting than the stories written by the people who see themselves to be at the sort of top of society can be. I've written about women, I've also written about gay men and sort of criminals, and so I think there is a sense that those marginal stories are something I find interesting. Having said that, I'm sure I would love to write a biography of the Duke of Wellington or something. Nobody's ever suggested it, and
that's interesting in itself that nobody's ever suggested it. I mean,
well, but also I haven't pursued it, but the things I've written about have always been quite idiosyncratic anyway. My husband always complains that I'm not writing sort of big books, but I really like the smaller book.
Is it possible that by being interested in outsiders, marginalised characters, not writing a big book in those very masculine terms, aren't they? A big thumping history of as you said it yourself, single word topic. Yeah. Does that make writers like you marginalised themselves?
It's quite possible that it does. I think in some ways I like being on the margins. I quite like the fact that because not that many people buy my books, I don't have that great a responsibility to an audience. I feel free in terms of what I can choose to write about. And because publishers don't have a lot depending on me in terms of my, you know, I'm not writing a cookery book that must sell hundreds of thousands in order for them to be able to pay for writers like me. It means that, yes, that small scale thing makes it both more intimate and more manageable. And I don't have a lot of the demands that I might feel uncomfortable with. I'm not specially interested in massive lecture tours or, I mean, for me, I'm very happy if I go to a literary festival and I've got five people, I'm really much happier sitting down to talk about a subject in an intimate setting than standing up and talking to 250 people about something.
You've used all sorts of words that were in my thinking, having read your work. I mean, you use the word intimate, you use the word freedom. I mean, these are very much themes in your work. But I just want to take you back to Lady Fanshawe's receipt book, which is, you know, itself, this is not a study of a grand political document. It's a receipt book, and that is something private and modest. What drew you to it?
It was the combination of the two sources. So to have her memoirs, which are published and have been known about and studied by life writers and that sort of thing over the past 150 years. But the receipt book wasn't very well known. It was known about by food historians, but it's only been in the public domain for the last 20 years. And so nobody'd written about the two things together. So in the memoirs, you have quite a straightforward narrative of what her life was like and how she wanted to remember it. But with the receipt book, you have the other angle of it, the unscripted side of things. The memoirs are very much her commemoration of the life she lived and how she wanted her son, particularly her son, to remember it. The receipt book, which she handed to her daughters, is about how to live not how she did live.
How interesting. And she lived during the Civil War, if you can explain.
So she was born in 1625. She was coming up to adulthood as the Civil War broke out. She married in 1644 to someone who, like her, her family, were passionate royalist, devoted to the cause of Charles II, unable to participate in public life or any kind of public life at all in England because of their allegiance to the monarchy. And so they lived a very marginalised life for those 20 years of her adulthood, which was completely opposite to what she would have expected as growing up as a child. So growing up in the 1630s, where her father was one of the most important customs officers for the crown and a very rich, completely self-made man, her husband's family also working in the Exchequer, very rich because of the crown, prosperous, established, secure. The life she imagined that she would have when she was 15 or 16 was totally unlike the life she ended up having, and I was really interested in that. And it spoke to me the idea of the huge social change that happened, which...
Because of the Civil War.
Because of the Civil War. We think of it as being something... But as everything, as historians, we look back and say, oh, it was only actually 10 or 15 years, and then it all sort of went back to how it was. A bit like with the French Revolution, it's very easy to look at the narrative of it as being something that, because it the pendulum swings back again, to think that everything just returns to normal. But actually, huge change has taken place, and people's lives have been completely turned upside down. I hesitate to say destroyed, because she was never hungry because of the war. She was never, she was a refugee and an exile, but she was never, you know, arguably the tragedies of her life might easily have happened, the children dying and that kind of
but
stuff.
This is an extraordinary number of children dying.
That's normal for the times, though. That really is. That was just chance. There were people who had 11 children, every single one of whom died before the age of 10. There were people who had 11 children, every one of whom grew up. And then most people went somewhere in the middle.
So the 20 pregnancies, I think, is that right? And how many surviving children?
Five survived. Four girls and a boy.
And the stories you tell of, you know, travelling by horseback, by ship, fleeing, escaping, being forcibly moved. Mm. I mean, I would shrink from it as a non-pregnant,
I know, I know. Well, I don't think they worried about that too much. I mean, I think you did just get on with it. And that was, I loved learning about those kind of attitudes. I felt that that sense of adventure that she always had when facing the challenges of that life in exile that they led felt so modern to me, the idea that you just got on with it. And it didn't matter what the conventions of the time were, you had to transcend them.
It seemed to me that I hesitate to call it the background, you know, the Civil War in England being background or in Britain. You are telling two stories at the same time. You're telling her story and the story of the history, the story of the time. Did you set out always to write a new kind of history of the Civil War, or did that simply emerge?
I think that simply emerged. I mean, for me, I deliberately didn't put very much historical background, except where it was something that I felt that she would have been either thinking about it herself or affected by it. So I didn't, for example, write anything about the Puritans of the time, because that was completely out of her ken. She wasn't interested in those kind of radical religious views, things like the Levellers. She just wouldn't have had any impact on her life. And so I deliberately, it's a very narrow story in a sense, because it's only about her life. So I'm interested that you think that it is a history of the Civil War as well, because for me it was very much always meant to be about her.
Yes, but it felt like a different way of writing history,
actually,
to an experiential version of it.
Yes.
And for me, it was simply easier to translate myself mentally into the moment, because I was living along, you know, within her consciousness in the way that you presented it.
That's so lovely to hear.
And also, but you know, these two sources you mentioned, I love that. The one passed to her son, the memoir, and the other one passed to her daughter, the receipt book. You know, there is something there, is there not, about which history wins, whose version, who's kind. And I wondered whether for you, did the receipt book, the material in there, changed the way you understood what it was like to have lived through the 1640s and 50s?
Oh, absolutely. The sense, I mean, you get a sense with the receipt book when you look at it. first of all, of her privilege. Even though she's living through terrible times, this book is an expensive object. It's been beautifully written out by a secretary who was working for her husband, who she had access to. But for me, what I loved about it, and what I love about any kind of historical document, is there's always something that they can't control about how they present it. So on the surface, it's this beautiful, expensive book with immaculate handwriting, telling a life, a story of how life ought to be led. This is how food should be prepared. This is how your guests should be looked after. This is how you must look after your linen and make your candles and to create this wonderful world. I mean, it's a bit like reading a modern House and Garden or something like that. But you can't then stop the remedies for this has worked really well on a child with worms. Smallpox remedies, we know they didn't work, and yet she's still got three of them because so many of her children suffered from smallpox. It's hope over experience. Her husband gets scurvy. That's her writing out the remedies, crossing them out where they don't work. And what's really interesting about those as well is that she overworks them. So if she when her husband has scurvy, the remedies for scurvy, scurvy grass, that's the folk remedy, which is full of vitamin C. That's why it was effective. She's trying to distill it. So she's trying to use a modern technique, a new technique, to make it more potent. In fact, she weakens its potency. And so that, for me, was also fascinating, seeing what would have worked and what didn't work. And also talking to, I spoke to a herbalist who's really interested in the history of herbalism and these, you know, this system of the humours, and there were names of herbs from her remedies which I couldn't read, though I could read them, they were legible, but I couldn't find them in the OED. And he looked at them, and there were a couple of points where he said, oh yes, of course, that's another name for such and such, and we use it treating depression. It's in a remedy for melancholy. Those kind of things I found absolutely fascinating.
It interested me as well how you linked this, her distillation, her interest in the herbology, to what seemed to be a burgeoning interest of involvement of women with chemistry. I mean, there are what seem to be proto-women scientists, and this seems to be an area, the woman's sphere, which totally surprised me.
Yes, it was a sphere in which men and women worked equally up until the foundation of the Royal Society. So you get the brilliant Sir Kenelm Digby, who's one of the founding members of the Royal Society, who has his laboratory, but it's actually a distilling room, in his rooms at Gresham College. But literally what he's using is exactly the same as any housewife would have had in her distilling room in her house for making these ointments and cordials and wines and medicines.
The point that interested me was that there is this window, it seems, as you describe it, where the instability of the times, like we always tell the story about the First World War, you know, when we went and got jobs, it seems to have opened.
Yes.
And then closed again.
Yes.
Is that have I understood it correctly?
Definitely. I don't think it opened and then closed. It's more that it was open and then it closed. So it wasn't that there was just a window of 10 years when women had access to this sort of stuff. I think it was their tradition. That was women's work. The sphere of household management included, had come to include, in its developments over the previous centuries, very, very sophisticated methods of cooking and distilling and medicine. And they reached such a level that men decided that they would take over.
I'm not going to defend my sex. But beyond the chemistry, the distillation, women were having voices in politics, in government, in a way that, I must admit, surprised me. Lady Fairfax heckling at the trial of Charles I. There is a raised voice of a woman in the most charged context. And was there also a window there where women were politically present in a way that was different or did eventually change?
There's several interesting aspects about that. There's definitely a sense that royalists allowed women to have more of a voice than Puritans did. In some senses, Puritans, on the radical fringes, there were female preachers and that sort of thing. But on the whole, the Puritans were kind of classically austere, in the same way as the French revolutionaries were, about the role. Women's role was to raise good revolutionaries or good republicans in the home. Whereas royalists, who have this this more romantic idea of the relationship between men and women allow women to have a stronger voice. So Henrietta Maria, who's constantly going on at Charles I about what he ought to do and what da-da-da-da-da-da, and in many ways loses the whole thing for him because she's actually such a source of bad advice and listens to such bad advice herself. But the fact that her voice is so important is very much a royalist thing, and Anne Fanshawe was very much part of that. It was a companionate marriage. It was a romantic marriage. And in that, it's very hard for one party to be dominant or preeminent.
I see. I suppose the danger in pursuing this line of basically being pleased and excited in a 21st century sort of way that women have a political presence is in thinking that that's when and where they become important. But what I really loved about what Lady Fanshawe does is that you see the importance
of what else she's doing.
Or what else she's doing in the domestic sphere. I mean, did you feel... I suppose the ultimate question is it as important to distill the remedy for scurvy, to press the linen, to bear the children, as to have a political role?
It's a different thing, but it is of no less value, I suppose. I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, feminist historians have studied Lady Fanshawe because she's one of the earliest life writers. And several of them slightly dismiss her because she writes her husband's life, ostensibly. She's not writing her own life. She's not trying to publish. She's not trying to put herself out there. She's very much within the... Admittedly, writing itself was a feminist act at that time, but... she is still within the kind of bounds of respectability. She's not writing directly about herself. She's not trying to publish her work. She's not trying to make a living from her work, all of which were very frowned upon. Having said that, as you say, these other roles that women perform, you know, are they less valuable? I'm not sure that they are. And I also think whenever I look back, and I found this with Maharani's, with Liberty as well, the idea that women... aren't listened to just because the structures of society don't give them an official voice seems to me absurd, because I can't imagine how you can live with strong women and not listen to their voice, because there's never been a time when women haven't, you know, even if it's in bed at night, you're still saying, I'm not sure that was a good idea. Or, you know, it seems to me very hard to suggest that women were always meek and obedient and mild and stitching their sewing patiently. And there may have been some women like that, but I don't know very many now. And I can't imagine that 500 years ago, the characters I know would have behaved differently.
I suppose their voices...
they were meant to be behaving differently.
What's striking, of course, is that you do cover the whole spread from the public to the most private. I mean, one of the things I love about your work is... this very nuanced attention to details of dress, fabric, you know, the socio-cultural economic role it plays. Is it unfair to consider that as the woman's sphere? I mean, historically it always was. And I mean, is this the female sphere of history?
I don't think so at all. Something I read years ago, actually when I was doing Liberty, by the historian Richard Cobb, great social historian of the French Revolution, writing about the incidences of suicides of young girls in the years 1795, 1796. And on their, when they're hauled out of the Seine, everything they're wearing and carrying on them is written down as part of the police records, and Cobb made a study of this. And his description of the colours of the clothes that they were wearing, many of which would have been handed down to them, they as maids or grisettes or whatever, they were the most humble in society, but they were wearing clothes that would have been, you know, maybe through three or four or five other people come down to them. So you get the fashionable colours of the 1770s and 1780s showing up on these, in the patched clothes of these girls dying in the 1790s. And his list of the colours that they used, which were the fashionable colours when Marie Antoinette was popularising them, was so poignant. It's one of my great inspirations. And it's very much Richard Cobb, not a female writer.
That is interesting.
I don't think it should be male or female.
No, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I suppose what I'm digging at is... you get grand old men writing grand old histories of war and state level politics. But it's interesting that you don't conceive it in those terms at all. I mean, you're not in fact fighting any kind of...
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm led by what I'm interested in, but I love, I mean, as a reader, I absolutely love, I love things like Patrick O'Brien and Bernard Cornwell. You know, I think men are just as interested in those details. It's just a slightly different take, maybe. But even then, that's the detail is the fun of it.
Yes. There is one moment only where I felt you were writing as a woman in a way that a man could not.
Mm.
And it was when you described how Lady Fanshawe's receipt book was handed down to her daughter and how that you also had a book of recipes, as we would call them now. And I felt suddenly there that there is a lineage which I am simply not part of.
How interesting. Yes, I definitely, one of the things I loved about it was this sense. I've got a book is the wrong word, but I have a sort of tattered old bundle of bits of paper of, oh, you know, Granny used to make me cheese souffle whenever I used to go and stay with her, and so she taught me how. So I've got her piece of paper and I save it because it's in her writing. And I don't think that's necessarily gendered, but it is definitely a sense of lineage. And in my family particularly, my mother's one of five girls with a boy at the end. We very much felt we were living in a matriarchy as grandchildren. So I definitely am attuned to those, to that sense of female line.
Hmm. Well, that leads me really to the question of where, as a historian, the feminist slant element in your work, where does it come from? How did you catch this?
I think it's in the air, isn't it?
The question
is, definitely strong women in my family. My mum would call herself a feminist, absolutely. She always worked. I think those kind of things are basic, really, aren't they? But my granny loved stories about people and how they were connected to each other. And that's one of the most fun things about research, I think, is when you're researching a subject and you're seeking connections and links. And Gran had that because she was part of a huge family. And so she always remembered that somebody was married to somebody else and that person, she could join the links over an extraordinary breadth. And I always loved those stories of hers, and I'm sure that that's part of what made me interested in the kind of work I do.
That was Lucy Moore in conversation with James McConachie. You can find out more about Lucy on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 227, which was recorded by James McConachie and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 228, Brian Keeney speaks with Robin Blake about growing up London Irish and the challenges of identity that presented, jumping from a secure teaching job into the precarious freelancery of writing, and how he wrote his first novel to discover the secret behind a pair of mysteries. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.